Hello and welcome to the Beach House 34 True Crime and Paranormal Podcast. I'm your host, Christine Wirth. Before we get into this episode where Darlie's defense team begins to question Charles Lynch, I want to recommend to everyone listening to please head on over to TikTok where Darlie's baby sister, Danelle, is having discussions about these trial readings here at Beach House 34. This is where you can learn a lot more about the case and even ask her questions that might not have been answered in the coverage of the actual trial itself. And lastly, if you enjoy these episodes and want to show some love, subscribe or hit that like button wherever you listen to your podcast. And if you have the ability, I also have a Patreon if you'd like to help in that way. I'll have all of the links to Danelle's TikTok, the YouTube channel where you can now see all of the visuals, at least the ones that I have access to. I'll have the link to that YouTube channel and Patreon all in the show notes. And if you're interested in learning where we left off in the last episode, that would be Charles Lynch number 2. And let's go ahead and get started with Darlie's defense team now taking over the questioning of Charles Lynch. Mr. Lynch, I have a lot of areas to cover with you. And as I have said to other witnesses, sometimes I have got my notes on some of the stuff that I want to cover, and I may bounce around a little bit. So if at any time you think maybe we have lost communication with what date or time or event we are talking about, stop me and we will go back and make sure that we're on the same wavelength. And you have been kind, and I thank you for the opportunity to visit with you on various occasions. I noticed that after I called you the other night on Thursday, that you apparently called Mr. Davis. I have talked to Mr. Davis since then. Yes, sir. And you told him that I had called you. I told him that you had a better opinion as to when I was expected to testify than what the state had told me. I was right about that, wasn't I? You were. But after we have visited with you these various times, you have called the district attorney and you have told him what we've talked about with you, haven't you? In general, okay. And you have not felt the need to call me and tell me about what you and the district attorney have talked about, have you? No, sir. And you made one comment about you had asked, and I don't recall this, but I won't quibble with you. You had asked us maybe on the 31st about additional testing and whatever, and nobody answered you? Right. And you know, of course, from your experience that defendants are presumed innocent, don't you? That's right. And that the defendant has absolutely no burden of proof whatsoever. I have not been to law school, but that is what I hear. You understand that? Yes, sir. So that wouldn't strike you as unusual, would it? No, it wouldn't. When Mrs. Routier came down there on the 17th, she voluntarily came down there with her husband? Yes, sir. And the child? And they gave you head hair? Head hair and blood samples. And they were fully cooperated with you? Yes, sir. Did whatever you asked of them? That's right. Answered your questions? That's right. And fully discussed anything you needed to discuss with them? That's correct. That was on the, what day? 11th, was it? That sounds about right. I think my timeline is in the green folder. What's a timeline? Do you have one summary area? It should be a loose page in there. I don't see it, but it's, I believe it was June 11th. I guess it was the 11th. I'm pretty sure about that. The main point I want to make is that they did everything. They came down there voluntarily and they did everything that you asked them to do. That's right. Now, you have been at Swift's a number of years and talked about your basic background. Did you say you are mainly hair and fiber now? Right now, I am a hair and fiber examiner. And in the process of setting up a mitochondrial PCR DNA lab. And I'm also setting up a laboratory to do fluorescence and in situ hybridization of tissues for sex typing. So yes and no. Now, are you going to do, well, you have been in trace evidence, and it kind of looks like you are taking on some newer responsibilities? Yes, sir. And that, is it mitochondrial? Mitochondrial DNA testing. That is the one where you test DNA, like in Jesse James. Well, the usefulness of mitochondrial is when you cannot get nuclear DNA out of anything else, you can often extract mitochondrial DNA from simply the hair shaft with no tissue or very old bones, like Jesse James. But the information you glean from that is not as discriminating as nuclear DNA. And that is something that is being done at Swift's? No, not currently. The only crime lab that is currently doing casework in it is the FBI in Washington. I was inartful in the way I said it. The work you are doing now is with a view of being able to get that capability at Swift's. I am setting up the lab. Yes, sir. Okay. And Swift's presently has DNA capability, do they not? Yes, the nuclear DNA capability, that's right. How many people are there at Swift's? There are two, ballpark number. Well, the entire building or the crime laboratory? Well, let's just do the crime lab. There's probably about 20 analysts. How many of those are in the DNA section? There are two DNA analysts and there's one DNA technician. And what has been the history of trace evidence? Is that something that has really sort of come on to its own in more recent years? The instrumentation for doing fiber comparison has gotten better through the years. Hair microscopy has not changed significantly since 1863 or 4 when it was first done. But again, the scheme of approaching hair evidence is changing, and microscopy is the first part. DNA is possible to be the second part, but the microscopy doesn't go away. You still have to use that to screen the evidence. Trace evidence is a big, broad area of things. It's accelerant identification in arsons, paint identification, gunshot residue analysis, glass comparisons. The technology to examine such materials is getting better, but hair is just like it was in 1863, basically. But as far as the analysis of fibers and the comparison and electron microscopes and all that stuff, that's of more recent vintage. It's been available for 10 years or so. Okay. And would it be fair to say that trace evidence is evidence that could easily be overlooked by just the naked eye? Absolutely. And lack of training? Absolutely. And the importance of trace evidence is that oftentimes there aren't large and observable clues. Isn't that true? That's right. Oftentimes there aren't bloodstains leading out of a house. That's right. Oftentimes there aren't fingerprints. That's right. Oftentimes there are not scuff marks on walls. That's right. Oftentimes there are not things disturbed that are obvious. Well, what kind of... Are you talking about all situations or a specific scenario? Well, that is a good point. You have never been to two crime scenes that were alike, have you? Well, not separate events. I have been to a crime scene with 130 deceased persons at one crime scene. Well, you went to the Delta crash, didn't you? That's right. All right, but every crime scene is unique to itself, isn't it? Sure. And it's got to be viewed that way, doesn't it? If you are going to do your job, that's right. You have got to be open to whatever it is and not draw any hasty conclusions about what is there or not there. The approach will vary, right? But you never want to draw a hasty conclusion, do you? No. Now, while we're just on that subject, in this particular instance, you wouldn't expect this assailant to have much blood on him, would you? The assailant who had stabbed the two children? Yes. And possibly wounded Mrs. Routier? Yes. That is variable. It could possibly be done with no blood getting on the assailant. That is right. So it is entirely possible that an assailant could have gone in there, killed two people, stabbed her, left the house without leaving any blood drops that he had dropped anywhere? That's possible. And you can't say one way or another, can you? Whether it should or shouldn't have happened, or would or wouldn't have happened. Well, I can say it's possible that it wouldn't have happened. Right. Now, as I understand it, you went back on the, I believe it was the 11th or 12th for another visual inspection walkthrough. That's right. Again, I don't have that page. Okay. Who was present for that? That would be the second visit. Dr. Icy Stone, my supervisor, went. Catherine Long, Greg Davis, investigator Mike Basillo with the district attorney's office, and I don't recall the specific police personnel. I was curious about one thing while you were saying that. Are you sure that on the 6th, you went out there without somebody calling you? I'm certain. Nobody called you to ask you to come down from Rowlett. You volunteered and went? No, nobody ever calls me. I'm like the Maytag man. Okay, I'm going to leave that one alone. And on the 6th, I'm sorry, on the 11th, were you primarily looking for bloodstains at that time? That was the interest at that time. Yes, sir. And it sounded to me like most of the focus of that was outside. Some of it was outside. I would say it was equal focus outside around the gate and driveway area and in the family room. So I take it that at least at that time that you thought it was possible that Mr. Cron and everybody else had overlooked some blood. I wanted to see what they had taken and had not taken. Okay, you wanted to see for yourself, didn't you? Yes. Now, what kind of things can interfere with taking blood outside of, or observing it, or testing for it? Is the weather a factor? Oh, yes, it can wash it away. But in the instance of a big stain, you would still expect there to be some reactive residue. But a small stain might be washed away? Yeah. As a matter of fact, there was a large thunderstorm on the night of the 7th, wasn't there? I don't know. You would recognize Catherine Long's handwriting, wouldn't you? Yes, sir, I do. Do you remember discussing with Catherine Long on the 7th some additional things that you and she wanted done? Yes, I do. I met her later on in the evening of the 6th. The 6th? Okay. It turned into a letter on the 7th? Yes, sir. Let me show you a document out of Miss Long's file. I recognize it. And you recollect doing that? I recollect talking to her. And then she told me that she was going to fax this to Rowlett. Does that also refresh where she says down there, quote, even after last night's rainstorm, let's try to get some samples outside? That is present on this. That is what it says, isn't it? Yes, sir. Do you now recollect that there was a rainstorm on the 7th? No. Okay. If Miss Long's recollection is correct, that could certainly hinder your ability to find bloodstains out there on the 11th, couldn't it? Yes, it could. Outside. Okay. On the 6th, when you were out there and you saw this blood area, would you call it a smudge, or what would you call it? In the garage? Are you talking about in the garage? Yes, sir. It appeared to be a faint shadow of light, powdery blood material. Could you say consistent with new blood, old blood? Didn't look like a primary transfer. It looked like a secondary, tertiary type transfer. Okay. But it's in what you've described as a powder state or powdery look? Yes, sir. Okay. I've sort of gotten lost on that. Was it on the garage floor or on a sign? My memory of it was that it was actually on the white plastic sign in front of the freezer. And how was the sign? Was the sign up? No, it was lying flat on the floor. The sign was on the floor? Right. Okay. And as you were going out there, who noticed that first? Well, let me go back. When you were there making the first time that you saw, who was with you? Catherine Long, and I can't remember if Mr. Cron was with us or not, but I think it was found in his absence, and then I directed his attention to it. So when you pointed out that stain, did it appear that Kron had not previously been aware of it? He had told me earlier that there was no blood in the garage. Okay. I asked him, what about this? All right. So had Kron told you there was no blood in the garage, Mr. Lynch goes out, he finds blood in the garage, and then you went back to Mr. Kron and said, what about that blood in the garage? Right. And Kron had never mentioned that blood in the garage to you? Right. Did Kron have an instant answer? He said he felt like it had probably been tracked out there. Kron told you that the blood that he had not yet seen had probably been tracked in there by a paramedic or somebody. Is that right? That's right. Did he use the word paramedic? No, police or whoever was, you know, something like that. Just somebody, some other person? Right, one of the first people responding. Now, while we're on who observed what, when you went in the utility room the very first time, was there a ball cap in the middle of that floor? I didn't see one. As a matter of fact, you testified previously in this case that there was not one, didn't you? Yes, sir. You were certain about that. That was my best recollection. Did you see that ball cap somewhere else? I first saw it in a crime scene photograph. Okay. And where was it at that time? It was sitting pretty much in the middle of the floor, I think in front of the washer and dryer. That sort of stuck out to you in your mind, didn't it? Oh, yeah. Because you had been there and you had never seen what was depicted in that photograph? I didn't recall it. Okay. And that is sort of why it stuck out at that time, wasn't it? That I never saw it. You were thinking, I never saw this. I had no memory of it. And as a matter of fact, you know it was not collected until sometime later? That's right. Was that what, 2-3 weeks later before that? Actually, a search warrant was run to go get it, wasn't it? Yes, it was. And several weeks later, after the crime scene had been released? I don't know how long, but it was some days afterward. Now, other than the blood on the sign, is that the extent of the blood that you saw in the garage? Yes, sir. Other than the small particulate stuff on the top of the window. What kind of bug was that? One with a bunch of legs. All right. Now, Mr. Lynch, over the years, you have been called on to testify a number of times in Dallas and other counties, haven't you? Yes, sir, I have. First time down in Kerrville? First time. Okay. And you previously, in this case, you have testified about your observations on this head hair. Is that not right? That's right. And your testimony, and you have been straightforward about that and candid about it, you had a head hair from Mrs. Routier that you got on the 11th, correct? Right. And was it you that found another head hair in that screen? In the window. In the window. Right. Okay. When did you locate that? Do you need your notes? It would be helpful. Okay. I reported that comparison on June 28th. You reported it. What does that mean? That means that is when this report was typed. Okay. When I actually did the comparison would have been 1 or 2 days prior to that. Okay. So you had the head hair on the 11th. You had removed it from the screen on the 25th, give or take. Well, that would be about right. Now, when you observed that, I guess you take it carefully and do you put it on a slide or where do you take it? When you remove a hair from an article, most examiners put down a layer of xylene and then put that hair, the hair in that, drain off the excess xylene and use Permount as a resin to affix the glass microscope slide on top of it. And then you are ready for your microscopic examination. And then you did examine it under the microscope? Yes, sir, I did. And while you were there, you have Darley Routier's known head hair right alongside it? That's right. Do you do that same microscope where you put them all? How do you call that? It's a comparison microscope. It's a 2 compound microscopes connected by a bridge, and the examiner is able to look at what's under each microscope and move the stage with the controls. That's sort of like these photographs you had over here, where you have got one on one side and one on the other, and that's right. You don't have to move the hair off the microscope to really compare them. While you are moving it, you can go from root end to tip and move it around. Okay. And you can do that on both sides, right? Yes, sir. You can go out the length of the hair, right? And you observed that it appeared that that head hair that you had gotten, that you had found, that it had been forcibly removed. That's right. And you could see that under the microscope. It had been jerked out, right? Okay. And as if someone had climbed through the window and the hair had been pulled out, or the hair had been pulled out and then was shed from a hand or whatever coming out of the window. Where was this? Up in the top part of the window? It was embedded in a felt runner on the side of the window. Okay. And this window, do you care about the history of that window? Well, you know, I think that we have done the history of that window probably enough. All right. Now, then you observed that it had been appeared to be pulled out. Yes. When you go through that, tell me all the things that you go through to identify the, how did you call it? Appeared microscopically identical? Yes, sir. Tell me what all you do to see that that head hair was microscopically identical to Darlie Routier's. May I step down and draw? I draw a lot better than I talk. Yeah, would you like a grease pencil? Or else this may be permanent if we don't have one. Here, I'll bring you something. All right, Mr. Lynch, you keep moving a little too close for the jury, so can you draw large enough? Let me get my notes. The court then asks, can all members of the jury see that easel? They respond with, yes, sir. The court says, all right, thank you. And then Mr. Mosty continues. All right, you are going to, why don't you tell us how you go about that and all of the things you are looking for? And as you go, if it's helpful, what you observed when you saw these to be microscopically identical. First thing you have to understand, if you are going to understand what a hair examiner is looking for, is what is the structure of a human hair or any mammal hair for that matter. A lot of people describe a hair like a wooden pencil. The yellow paint on the pencil would correspond to the cuticle, which is overlapping scales on the hair. The wood of the pencil would correspond to the cortex. The cortex is dried. Why don't you write cuticle? Would I call that the outer layer of the hair? Yes, the overlapping scale. Within the cortex or the wood of the pencil, there are pigment grains. A dark-headed person will have denser pigment, and this is a very critical comparison characteristic for the microscopy. The pigment grains will, from person to person, line up in a particular pattern. And it's through this pattern comparison and analysis that a person comes to an opinion as to whether or not this person could have donated the hair that is found. The pigment is also used for racial determination. Hairs from a Black person have more clump pigmentation than Caucasian. The Caucasian pigmentation is generally finer. The other comparison characteristic of the hair is what we call the medulla. The medulla would correspond to the lead or graphite of a pencil. It's actually a hollow airspace coming down the center of the hair. Not all hairs have medullas. Some of them have continuous medullas. In addition to this, you have occurrences at the root end that are accumulations of small bodies called cortical fusi. And as Mr. Mosty mentioned, you can tell whether or not hair has been forcibly removed by looking at the root end. If you find a bulb like this, this is what we call a telogen growth phase or a resting growth phase. This hair was probably naturally shed. In the instance of a hair that has been forcibly removed, you can get several different root end appearances. In the instance of bleaching, the bleaching chemicals remove the pigmentation, so the examiner no longer has the most important feature that he uses in doing hair comparison. The same thing with gray hairs. Gray hairs, totally gray hair, has no pigmentation. So my gray hair compared to somebody else's gray hair would be less conclusive than a pigmented hair compared to a pigmented hair. There are hairs that are referred to as common featureless blondes. They are natural blondes, but just about every instance of hairs from a blonde scalp that I have observed, there have been at least some of these in there. So that is a very common hair. So the point is that some hairs are better than others for comparison. There are some hairs that I see on the microscope that I have never seen that type of hair before. So that testimony is very different than a hair that has nothing of real value to compare. Okay, now these are all factors, and do you just go through as sort of a mental checklist of looking for all of these from the cuticle to the medulla to, or how do you go about that? Exactly as you said, you go from root end to the tip with the hair, the known hair from the known person, and the found hair. And that is exactly what you do. You go from root end to tip, and you do that side-by-side comparison. For instance, you say that some medullas are solid. Yes, some medullas are broken. Yes, that's right. And so I take it that the medullas, as you look at that, you could see that these medullas were microscopically identical. In the instance of the found hair from the window, that hair had no medulla. Okay, so they were identical in that sense. Neither of them did. That's right. Okay, anything else we need to add to this? No. Okay. Now, you made that report on, did you tell me the 28th? Report on the 28th, and I found my notes that are dated June 27th. So I think that would be when I did the examination. Okay, so the report was the next day. And there are notes. The initial examination was on June 26th. Okay, and then you testified subsequent to that, that as you have said, that the hairs were microscopically identical. I said they were microscopically the same, had the same find, microscopic characteristics. That is the hair from the window and the hairs I had from Mrs. Routier. Okay. And at that testimony, you said that it appeared to be visibly, or what is the phrase, forcibly removed? That's right. Okay. And the fair conclusion from that testimony would have been that that was Mrs. Routier's hair, that somehow she had gotten her head in that window screen and it had been forcibly removed? No, if it were her hair, there are two conclusions. Well, first, that is one, isn't it? Yeah, that is one. All right. What is the second one? The second one would be for a perpetrator to have been involved with her and to have shed that hair as he went out the window. Okay. But that wasn't the inference that was being set out when you testified in this case after June 28th, is it? I was not there to do inference. I was just reporting a finding. All right. Would you agree with me that a fair inference could be drawn? That that would be the conclusion? That that was Mrs. Routier's hair as she left? I think it could go either way, really. Of course, at that, of course, and that is true of many, if not all of the items and evidence that you talked about, isn't it? You could interpret them more than one way, can't you? Some of them, sure. Okay. As a matter of fact, for instance, blood spatters. There is no one explanation for blood spatters, is there? Well, it depends on the appearance of the type spatter you are analyzing. Some of them are more conclusive than others, like hairs. Some hair is more conclusive than others. You know, there was a conclusion you drew to. I will get to it, I guess, in a minute, where I was thinking that very same thing. It's sort of like the glass is half full or the glass is half empty. You could draw whatever conclusion you wanted to from it, couldn't you? I report a scientific finding, and I leave it to the lawyers to do the conclusions. Well, whoever drew a conclusion that that was Darlie Routier's hair in that window was wrong, didn't they? Isn't that right? That firm conclusion was not reached. The conclusion that was reached was, at that time, she could not be excluded as the donor of that hair. No, my question is, anyone who drew a conclusion from what you had testified, from what you reported, and from what you have testified to. Anyone who drew a conclusion that that was Darlie Routier's hair that was taken out as she went out that window, that person drew a wrong conclusion, didn't they? They would be wrong in concluding that, and they would also be wrong in not concluding the other possibility of how that hair got there. And so in this instance, there was some subsequent testing done on this hair, wasn't there? That's correct. When was that done? The actual DNA testing? Yes. It was received at GeneScreen on September 26th. I don't know when they actually did the test. Okay. So you were made aware of the fact that your microscopic analysis, well, your microscopic analysis was correct, wasn't it? I would issue the same report today. Yes. You later found out that a scientific testing method had proven that what you saw was not, well, that it was not fair to draw the conclusion that it was Darlie Routier's hair from based on what you had seen. A more discriminating test excluded her as the donor of that hair. And of course, that is a scientific objective, controlled type of testing, isn't it? The DNA testing? Well, they get a type just like I do. So, really? Yes. So in any event, it's more discriminating than your eyeball with your microscope? If done properly, yes, sir. All right. And was it reported to you that the head hair was not Darlie Routier's? Yes. What did you do? I asked the Rowlett police officers if anyone with bleached hair had been in contact with that window. Did they tell you no? They told me that a naturally blonde person had been in contact with the window. Okay. So you went back and you took their word for that, right? Well, I was skeptical. All right. And you, were you skeptical enough to where you ordered that everybody down at Rowlett show up for a hair appointment? Well, I saw a particular officer in a restaurant. Her eyebrows looked like mine, so I demanded some of her hair at that point. And that, sure enough, that this time we really did find the hair, didn't we? She is microscopically the same, and she is the same with limited genetic marker testing. And so what that shows is that your microscopic evaluation, although done with the highest technology and with the greatest expertise, later proved that that head hair was not in fact Darlie Routier's. That's right. And it was also done with the knowledge that it was least conclusive because I didn't have a large number of comparison characteristics. But it was not so inconclusive that you didn't feel comfortable testifying in a court of law about it. No, I would testify today that the hair from the window was microscopically similar to the hairs that I got from Mrs. Routier. And I will also testify that the hair from the window is microscopically similar to the hairs of Sarah Jones, who is microscopically similar to Darlie Routier. So if a person puts too much stock in what is microscopically similar, they might draw the wrong conclusion? Oh, yeah. Okay. In your business as a trace evidence analyst, I assume that you oftentimes get clothing? Yes, sir, frequently. And is there a process known as combing of clothing? Yeah, no. How do you look for, first, visually, trace evidence, whether it be hair, semen, or bloodstain? How do you go about that? It's a naked eye observation first, and then we do taping with adhesive tape to remove stuff. When a woman is a victim of a crime, do you often get all of their garments? Yes, sir. Okay. Including underwear? Yes, sir. Okay. In this instance, you never got any underwear from Mrs. Routier, did you? No, sir, I did not. Does it strike you odd that a person who is getting ready to call 911 on the telephone wouldn't have on their panties? Well, I don't know. You don't know. No panties have ever been shown in this case, have they? Never. Let's talk about the knife. What you have, you can't say that that impression in the carpet is a knife, can you? Not to the exclusion of all other objects, no. Maybe it is, and maybe it isn't. It could be, and the corollary to could be is could not be, or maybe not. Or there is find me something better. Well, But you know that is not my job, don't you, Mr. Lynch? That is the state's job, isn't it? I see. You know that, don't you? I have not been to law school, Mr. Mosty. Okay, how about trusting me on that one? I'll trust you on that one. That is the state's job to exclude all of those other. Okay, so how about if we go with maybe so, maybe no? Is that good enough? It's of all the objects in the house, it was the one that fits best in that imprint. So you won't agree with me, maybe so or maybe no, maybe it is or maybe it isn't. Of all the objects in the house, it is the only one that I identified. Okay, but there are also lots of other things that could do that kind of stuff too. It could be a partial. As a matter of fact, reasonable people could differ about the importance of a blood stain, couldn't they? Sure. I mean, there are lots of different ways that blood stains could get there. It could be, for instance, the printout on the in the garage was not a full print, was it? It was a shadow of a smudge. Okay. Would you call it a shoe print? I couldn't be that specific. No. The one behind the carpet, would you call that a shoe print? That was a faint behind the couch. I mean, that was a faint shoe print. Okay. Now, was this area of carpet cut out? Where? Here. Not where the imprint is. No. Okay. The fibers that make up the imprint were snipped for blood testing. All right. You had apparently been out there two times before and missed this. That's right. And Kron had been out there and missed this. When did y'all find this? This was found after the carpet is removed from the house and has been taken to the Rowlett Police Department. In November, as I recall. Yes, sir. Okay. One thing I remembered was that we came and saw you on November 20th. Did you already have this appointment to go out there on the 21st? Or was it after we talked to you on the 20th? Did you call Mr. Davis? No, that was one time I did get called. I was called by him to go look. Okay. And you all went on the 21st, if I remember right. Well, it sort of struck me because it was the day after we were there. The day after that you visited with me? Yes. Well, anyway, it was in November, wasn't it? I don't need to belabor that. I think so. Yeah. Okay. And so everybody up until that time, nobody had said, golly, that could be a knife print in that carpet, to your knowledge. That's right. Now, Mr. Lynch, how would you describe this carpet? I know you know all that because you have told me how these shags are made, how carpet fibers are made. Yeah. All right. How do you describe this carpet at this house? Microscopically, or at the time I was there, or at the time I was at Rowlett, which time? How about understandably, so even I could understand it? Rephrase your question. I'm not sure what you are asking. Well, let me just go at it this way. If that knife was laid down on that carpet, you would expect to find carpet fibers on that knife, wouldn't you? If a bloody knife came in contact with that carpet, I would expect to find a couple of carpet fibers. Yeah. Well, and if this wasn't a bloody knife, then this whole exercise that we have gone through has been a big waste of time, hasn't it? Well, I mean, isn't the statement you made, quote, this could be a bloody knife outline? Right. I mean, if that was made with motor oil, we wouldn't be talking about it in front of this jury, would we? No. Okay. So, you know, for this knife to have caused that stain, that it must have been bloody. At least on the serrated portion, yeah. And you also know that had that been true, you, in your good judgment, think that you should have found carpet fibers on that knife? In testing that was done, when a bloody knife is put to that carpet, very often a carpet fiber would come back with the knife when it is removed. And so, in fact, it's inconsistent. I'm not going to sit here and say that carpet fibers will always transfer to a bloody knife from that carpet. No, and that is one of those that you could sort of interpret either way, maybe so or maybe no. It could happen, right? Okay, but in your judgment, you think that is surprising to you that you would not find, if that knife went down on that floor, It surprises you that you would not have carpet fibers on that knife, doesn't it? If that knife went down on that floor and went directly to me, I would be surprised. Okay. If that knife went to that floor and went someplace else and had an opportunity to partially dry so that any fibrous material might fall off of it, then you would have to consider that. Of course, that knife had fibrous. It had materials on it, didn't it? Yes, it did. And you detected a lot of them off that knife, didn't you? Yes. You found, for instance, there was a deer hair on it? No, not on that one. No. On the murder knife, there was not an antelope hair? No. What kind of hair was it? There was no animal hair? No, there was domestic animal hair, dog or cat. I'm sorry. There was a domestic animal hair on that knife. And so, doesn't it stand to reason that if the domestic animal hair is not wiped off, the carpet fiber probably wouldn't have been wiped off either? No, it depends on where it occurs, what it comes in contact. Maybe it could be and maybe not. Is that right? Right. It's just hard to draw any solid conclusions from that, isn't it? Well, you can't always assume that you found what was transferred to it by the time it gets to the laboratory. And you have previously told me that you would expect to see carpet fibers on that, the bloody knife, wouldn't you? Haven't you? If it comes directly to me, yes, from the floor. I don't recall you mentioning that part of it when we talked before, do you? No, I don't. Without belaboring it, you have got other objects, such as cat hairs or dog hairs. Whichever they were, they had stayed on there? That's right. Okay. Would you tell the jury what an artifact is? In any particular context? In a crime scene investigation context. It's something that is not real, created, unrelated to the offense. Okay. It could be, for instance, an officer going in and kicking a glass can create an artifact? Sure. Paramedics coming in and intervening, creating an artifact? Sure. Is it anything that is a disturbance in the crime scene? Is that fair? That's right. And all cases have artifact, don't they, essentially? It's impossible for a crime to occur and then be investigated and there not be some kind of disturbance. That's right. And then that is especially true when there is a great deal of chaos. Sure. And then the more victims, the more artifact is likely to be created. In general, yes. And more people in there, the more artifact is likely to be created. Right. The more rescue efforts that are done, the more artifact is likely to be created. Right. Okay. When you got there at noon, 12:30, had the evidence been collected? Pretty much. Some items had been, I think, as I indicated earlier, the bloody knife had been collected, the small palm print from the carpet had been collected, and the ongoing activity when I got there was search for fingerprints. Okay. Now, I guess even though you may be focused in an area, you have at least a working knowledge of serology and other areas of Swifts, don't you? Yes, sir. I have seen blood spilled one way or another almost every working day for the last 16 years. And you have seen and worked with all the other people at Swifts and their departments, and so you know proper procedures with them. Right. And now, if there were a white rag that had blood on it that was touching one of the victims, you would recommend that that be collected, wouldn't you? I'm sorry, a white rag? If there was any rag, okay, if there was a bloody rag that was touching one of the victims, you would recommend that that be collected, wouldn't you? No, you wouldn't? No. You don't think that could be important? No. And I guess if it's not, then we would never know whether it would be important or not. Well, let me make sure I understand you. Hypothetically, if the rag had been used as emergency attention to the victim? Yeah, let's say that. Let's say that that rag had been used as emergency attention to the victim, and it was still there. I would put that in the same category as EKG pads that are left on the floor. Okay. that would still hold true if someone had decided within 20 minutes that there had been no intruder? That's right. I would think that it would be of no value under any circumstances. Okay, afterwards, do you think there would be any way you would know if that, for instance, that bloody rag could have a perpetrator's blood on it? You wouldn't know until you got to the lab, would you? What does the rag look like? Is it blood-soaked, or is it have spatter on it, or, you know, those things come into play. Let's say it looked like Defendant's Exhibit 31. It looks like a bloody white rag there, and assume with me that there is a body under that dark blanket, okay? And that when the dark blanket is moved, that body actually has a hold of that white rag. The body is holding, is clasping this rag, holding on to that rag, or it's touching his hands. I don't know how you would call it, but it is touching his hands. And no, I would not collect that. You would not collect that? No. Okay. You don't think that that would have any, even possibly any subsequent importance? No. Now, if you saw two rags, would you put those in the same bag, two bloody rags? If they weren't already in contact, I wouldn't. Okay, and so to put two bloody rags in the same bag, that is not good police work, is it? If they come from separate places, then you should bag them separately. That is, if they are deemed of value to submit to the laboratory. Let's go to the shirt. Now I'm showing you State's Exhibit 25, and you have described some defects that I would call on the... Well, where would you call those? Top right shoulder or back right shoulder or what? Top right shoulder. Right on the seam? Right. Essentially on either side? Right. In front of and behind the seams. Okay. And you said that that was consistent with someone. How did Mr. Davis do that? Lift it up? Yes. And stab down? No. How? More like you pull up and then make the puncture. Pull up and stab back through? Right. Now, that shirt would move, wouldn't it? T-shirts are very elastic, very much like the skin, and a short, rapid jab would cause that defect. If I picked up my shirt like this, that shirt is going to move, isn't it? Right. Are you saying that you can identify two holes going through like that? I can say that there is an identifiable puncture here, an identifiable puncture back here, an additional, at least two other identifiable punctures back here that were made with a bloody blade. Are we through? On this first one, because it's in an area of puddling blood, I can't say a bloody blade made that, but I can on these back here. Yeah, but there is one up here. Right. So someone has to, of course, my shirt is tucked in, so it gets taut, doesn't it? Well, if I take my shirt out like this, it's looser, isn't it? It pulls. See how it pulls up? That is very different material from t-shirts. Well, but the movement of the shirt is the same, isn't it? Basically. And all that has to be done left-handed, doesn't it? It could be either way if the come through like this. If the person wearing the shirt is doing those, then it could be raised with the right hand, punctures with the left, or raised with the left, punctured with the right. And you are going surely agree with me that that is a maybe so, maybe no, isn't it? Well, those are punctures in that shirt. I don't know any other way they can occur and not involve the skin of the victim. This shirt shows to be cut with up in this right shoulder area. Yes, sir. And there is blood on the front. Right. And right where it's cut, there is no blood. Right. Don't you draw the conclusion from that that the front got bloody after it was cut? May I look at it a little closer? Yes, sure. With regard to this right upper shoulder area, yes, sir, I would say that this blood on the front occurred after it had been cut. Okay. So what that means is, what in easy terms, it was cut by the paramedic and At the time, it was not bloody on the front like it is now? Right. And that subsequently, because of the way it was handled, it became bloody on the front? Right. And that is blood that has been transferred from one part of the shirt. I guess you can't even say. Well, can you even say it came from the shirt? When the shirt is cut away from the patient, the material goes back, and any blood that is in this area on the stretcher will also get on that sleeve when it gets pushed back this way. Okay, so that blood up there could be transferred off of blood off the stretcher? That's right. Now, but of course now, this time she has gauze on her neck, so the bleeding is essentially stopped. You wouldn't expect much blood on the stretcher, would you? Well, the skin underneath the shirt is bloody. So somehow, when that is like that, and it's thrown actually away from the skin, isn't it? Right. This area that is now bloody? Right. So not likely it got that much blood on it from the skin? Well, once the patient, again, is on the stretcher, there would be some blood going back. Not that much, though? Well, would there be? I would think there could be. Pardon? I think there could be enough to make that stain. But you can't say, can you? Not positively. Could just as easily be that all of that staining happened after it was wadded up and put in this bag? No, I don't think so. You don't think so? No. But you can't tell me for sure, can you? One way or the other? Well, yeah, that kind of stain. If you have a bloody shirt and some areas are still clean, and you take that shirt prior to its drying, and you drop it in a sack, you won't get that kind of a transfer. That much blood does not transfer from another area of a bloody shirt. You might get a light shadow of blood, and even if you hard press it, you probably won't get that much blood. That depends on how bloody the shirt is, doesn't it? Well, if it's very, very bloody, as this one obviously was, this one is very, very bloody, right? So it depends, does it not, on what part came in contact with what? If this part came in contact with that, there wouldn't be much blood, right? But it wouldn't cause that transfer. I know, that is what I'm saying, right? However, this part, if it's like this, if I pick it up off the stretcher like that and do like that, then it sure could cause all that blood, couldn't it? Well, I don't think you would get that kind of soaking from a secondary transfer. If it's laid like that and put, no, and left, no. Do you think that you got that much soaking from laying it on the stretcher and then the paramedics removing it? Sure, could have done that, but it couldn't have been as much from the front of this. You have pooling onto a vinyl surface. How do you know that? How do I know the mattress is vinyl? Yes, how do you know if she has been attended and they have said she has stopped bleeding and she is bandaged? How do you know that there is pooling on that stretcher? Well, that would be my opinion, that there would be some blood pooling on the stretcher. But you've got no way of knowing that, do you? Well, I've got the shirt. The shirt tells you that there was pooling on the stretcher? Yes, sir. On another subject, you saw that wine rack out there, didn't you? Yes, I did. And you noticed that it was unstable, didn't you? I didn't really test it for stability. Well, you have called it unstable, haven't you? Well, it looked fragile. You have testified previously that it was unstable, didn't you? I don't recall. Let me correct that. Have you testified it's fairly unstable? My memory is that I was asked about the wine glasses on it, and I think I said they were unstable, but the rack itself, let me show you a portion of the transcript down at the bottom. And how did you describe the wine rack? Fairly unstable wine rack was in that area. Okay, all right, let's turn to the screen. And at this point, we're getting a little long and they start to talk about the screen from the garage. So I'm going to stop right here. And we will pick right back up where we left off in the next episode. So right out of the gate, we learn from Mr. Mosty of the defense team. He makes it known that Lynch would report back to the prosecution each time that the defense spoke with Mr. Lynch, but it didn't go both ways. We also find out that even when Lynch is confronted with the fact that his colleague, Catherine Long, who we've already heard from, asked him about a rainstorm that occurred on the 7th of June, he said that he didn't recall that there was a rainstorm that night, and that it might have gotten rid of some evidence that was outside. So he's shown this note. She says it in her notes. He just simply can't recall that, but he can recall a lot of other things. We find out that when he was going through the Routier home, if you remember seeing photos of a black baseball cap, a child's black baseball cap in the laundry room, Lynch said that on his walkthrough, he never noticed that there. And the photo, it actually clearly shows this ball cap sitting in the middle of the laundry room. But he said that it wasn't there when he was in the house. We find out that a search warrant was issued to go get this ball cap that seemed to show up from nowhere from the scene. But the search warrant happened to be issued several weeks after this photo was taken. And, you know, not a big deal, I guess, if nobody touched it. But here's the thing. The crime scene had already been released when this search warrant was issued. So they've done all their stuff. They've left the crime scene. They're all done with everything they have to do. They've released the crime scene. And then somebody's like, oops, we forgot to go get that ball cap that, you know, wasn't there originally, but all of a sudden showed up in the laundry room. So we hear about how Lynch, he had found a hair that was embedded into the felt portion of the garage window that with the cut screen. So what he did is he took this hair and he compared it with Darley's. We then hear more than we would ever care to know about head hair. Now, Lynch had testified that the hair that he had found in the window at the Routier home, he said this hair and Darley's hair were, quote, microscopically identical. Now, Mosty kind of corners him, saying that he believes that Lynch was trying to infer that the hair in the window was, in fact, Darley's. When DNA testing was done on the hair in late September of 1996, it was actually found out that the hair in the window was not, in fact, Darley's, but someone else's. So what Lynch did is he called the Rowlett Police Department and asked if there was someone working there that had blonde hair. And they said they had a, quote, naturally blonde female that worked for their department. Now, Lynch didn't really buy that and just kind of let it go, but ended up seeing a female officer with blonde hair in a restaurant. And he was actually able to get a sample of her hair. And turns out the hair in the window belonged to her, an officer, Sarah Jones. Now, when Lynch called the police department to ask whether that person knew that Sarah had naturally blonde hair or not, we don't know. It's also unknown if Sarah actually got on the phone with Lynch and answered the question for herself. It seems to me that the question was actually answered for Sarah without Sarah even knowing about it. We also learned that there was a shoe print behind the couch, and we have talked about this earlier in earlier testimony. A shoe print behind the couch in the family room that no one saw until the carpet was taken up completely from this room of the house and then taken to the Rowlett Police Department. I am floored that, no pun intended, that no one noticed this. To me, it just seems like shoddy work. And then they talk about the knife outline that Lynch said was on the carpet, that evidently this is another thing that no one had noticed at all until the carpet was taken into the lab. And it was pointed out that if this knife were that bloody, that it would have picked up some carpet fibers. Lynch said that he would expect that to happen, these carpet fibers to show up on this knife, if the knife went directly from this carpet area to him. And I don't know why that would have mattered, because the officers would have, you know, hopefully done the proper thing and bagged it for evidence, so nothing would have been missing on this knife. But nonetheless, Lynch did find domestic animal hairs on the knife. And his explanation, when he's asked about testing this knife, and he says that he found these domestic animal hairs on the knife, but evidently didn't find any carpet fibers. At least that's what I kind of gathered from the conversation. It just seems to me that that would be nearly impossible, right? So all of these hairs, like Lynch said, that they stuck, or if the knife dried or the blood dried, the hairs would have come off the knife, right? So if they had bagged this up properly, then all of the hairs would actually still be within the evidence bag itself. But I still don't buy it. I mean, are you telling me that, you know, domestic animal hairs are more adhesive than carpet fibers? I mean, if something's stuck on the knife, it's stuck on the knife, right? Now, let's move on to talking about the thing where Mulder, when he asked him about the rag next to the victim at the crime scene. I'm sure, just like you, you felt the same way. Maybe not. I don't know. But I'll tell you what, I am not an investigator. I am not a crime scene specialist. I'm not a lawyer. But when Lynch said that he would not collect a rag that was next to a victim at a crime scene, my jaw dropped. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. If anything, wouldn't this be an important item to collect? We then get into a discussion about Darley's t-shirt. And the problem with the transcript here is that there's a lot of descriptions as if they're pointing to someplace on the shirt, but it's hard to tell exactly what they're talking about because they're not real descriptive. They say, and here, and of course, I don't know where here is. However, Lynch does say that he would think that some of the blood got onto the t-shirt from the pooling of blood when Darley was placed on the stretcher for the ambulance. However, she was bandaged by that point. Lynch then, quote unquote, assumes that there would be blood pooling on the stretcher that she was laying on because it was vinyl and she was laying down. And so the shirt would have been with her and somehow she would have been bleeding all over the shirt or soaking in this pool of blood on the stretcher. So, you know, again, it's shocking to me that someone, especially in his position, would assume anything. You know, assumptions are not facts. Lastly, when Lynch is asked about the wine rack and its stability, he maintains that he didn't say that the wine rack was unstable. But then he was shown testimony from him, his own testimony, that says he did in fact say, quote, fairly unstable wine rack was in that area. So that's kind of where we ended up. We're going to move on in the next episode to talking about the window screen. We're still on the defense side of things. So Darley's defense team is still questioning him. And again, thank you, thank you, thank you all for listening. I appreciate you all so much. Please don't forget to subscribe, like, or even comment. That would be awesome. I would love that. So thank you. We will talk again very soon.